morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of May. Ron Elving is our guest this hour, one of our favorite all things political analysts. He is NPR News Senior Washington Editor, directs coverage of the nation's capital and national politics. He wrote an interesting piece about last week's presidential news conference. We'll start with that. We'll also talk about Israel appearing to be in the middle of serious civil war. We will talk about Bill Richardson saying over the weekend that the Democrats may see a face-off between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, adding that Joe Biden has always wanted to be president. The NRA had their annual meeting in Houston. We will talk about that. We'll talk about violence over the weekend in Afghanistan. And this story, which is so disturbing, the Bangladesh death toll over 600 now. How is the international community responding to that? Will those factories become safer? What responsibility does the international community bear in this? We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's how you reach us. Ron Elving, good morning. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Let's start with a piece that you wrote about the presidential news conference last week, in which you said that the president was mostly calm. But what stood out were the moments when he seemed at loss to deal with the ongoing frustrations of dealing with Congress. That didn't work out so well. Republicans wouldn't let me do what needed to be done. And you say that no matter how frustrating he finds this dilemma at the heart of our shared power system, it does not advance his cause to wear his frustration in public. How did he wear that in public, and why does it not advance his cause?
One of the ways the president shows his annoyance with the situation he finds himself in with a Republican House of Representatives and a strong Republican minority in the Senate is by sarcasm. Mm. So at one point when a reporter was kind of badgering him about what the reporter was calling failures of the administration, he got this look on his face and he said, golly. And I'm not making this up. He actually used the word golly and said, maybe I should just quit. Maybe I should just throw it in, you know, maybe it's all over. And he was obviously making fun of the question and being sarcastic about the question and sort of maybe even in a certain amount of humor that would be understood there in the briefing room in the White House, kind of kidding the reporter about being a little theatrical in the question and being a little theatrical in the way he confronted the president. But all of that gets lost when the average person, any normal person, sees the quotation from the president online moments later, hears it just moments later on the radio, sees it later on television, maybe sees it in the newspaper. It looks like the president was quite peevish. It looks like the president was in some measure losing his temper or so frustrated with the Republicans that he was, at odds with how to proceed. Now, I don't think any of those things is actually the case, but that is the impression that is created when the president allows himself to show a little bit of peeve, even in a sarcastic or an ironic way, when he's talking to the media. And that's something that this White House has never quite gotten on top of. And now we're into the fifth year. Fantastic presentations when the president is making a presentation, such as yesterday at Ohio State University, the president gave the commencement address, or at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where the president mm-hmm. was clearly the funniest performer of the night. Even more so than Conan O'Brien, who was getting paid. And the president was amazing. His timing, his humor, it was really quite professional. And yet when the president has to deal with these kinds of unscripted events with sassy reporters who are, you know, being a little bit provocative, he oftentimes seems to get off of his feed and does not create a good impression of his own confidence. Hmm.
And yet you also wrote that no one should doubt the Republicans are working to thwart this president. They would be the first to say so.
Oh, absolutely. And wear it on their sleeve very much, because that's the most important thing politically for a certain number of Republicans, especially those who are worried about primaries back in their home states for senators and back in their home districts for House members. There have been a number of senators who are no longer with us because they got beat by more conservative people in their Tea Party opponents, if you will, back in their home states, back in their home Republican parties, who came after them for being too cooperative and for going along with compromises. Pat Toomey, the very conservative Tea Party hero, really, from Pennsylvania, who's in the Senate from that state, a Republican, was one of the people who was pushing for background checks for guns last month. And he was one of the people who was part of the bipartisan compromise there. And he has said in the postmortem after that failed to get 60 votes and go forward, he said, you know, there are a lot of people in my party, the Republican Party, who were against this, not because they're against background checks for guns, but because they just didn't want to be for anything the president wanted so much. They would much rather be in a position of frustrating the president.
Hmm. Is that true?
I do believe it is true. I do believe that is always true of a certain hardcore within the opposition party, no matter who the president is. There were people like that with Ronald Reagan, believe it or not, way back in the 80s, and now it's in the mists of time and covered with myth, but there actually were people who resisted Ronald Reagan quite reliably and quite consistently during his presidency. Certainly we saw that with both Presidents Bush, and we certainly saw it with Bill Clinton. There are always going to be people in the opposition party who just oppose the president no matter what. The difference right now is that that is a large enough group of people that, given the Senate rules with the requirement for 60 votes on anything important, then that 60 votes is required to stop the filibuster that's always implicit in every opposition moment for the minority party. That group is larger now than it has been in the past and more powerful and is really driving the agenda for Republicans, House and Senate.
Mm. Ron, the president has been criticized by some for not having the best of negotiating skills, and let's point to the gun legislation, that he simply couldn't persuade enough people because he doesn't quite know how to do that. Is that true? Is that a fair criticism of him?
It's not his strength. It's not his long suit. He's much better at talking to large audiences of people. He's much better with a prepared presentation and much better at that sort of high-flying, hortatory rhetoric that he does so well. When it gets down to the nitty-gritty, if you want to call it that, where you say to somebody, look, I know the voters in your state pretty well. I think you can get them to go along with this if we do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and maybe there's that bridge you need over the Mississippi and so forth. And that kind of horse trading was much more the skill set of some other presidents in the past. I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of LBJ-type presidents, though, in the future. And even LBJ really was a historic accident because of the assassination of John F. Kennedy 50 years ago. Otherwise, he never would have been president. And he was an unusually inside player, an unusually good negotiator with other legislators, and he was basically a legislator at heart. And now we're more likely to get a series of presidents who are probably better at making the televised speech or making the big stadium speech the way our current president is.
So what does the president need to do, in your estimation, to better advance his cause?
He does need more allies in the middle, and he knows it, and he's been having dinners. He had a dinner with all the women in the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, 20 women in the Senate now, record number. He had them all to dinner. He also went out and had a couple of restaurant dinners, getting out of the whole atmosphere of the White House. You are my guests. You are my subjects. He went out to restaurants with groups of Republican senators and some mixed groups of Republicans and Democrats, an attempt for everyone to have a chance to kick back a little bit, get off the record, let their hair down, talk about what they all really want, what they all really need, what they all really fear. If you can have that kind of conversation, and if that conversation can go on beyond some tight little 15, 20-minute or 30-minute or even 60-minute format and let people really get relaxed with each other, actual communication can happen, and at that point, maybe a little trust can develop, and at that point, you can actually have legislation. The president is working at it. Maybe it's tardy. Maybe he should have done more of that in his first term. But now that he's been reelected, now that the focus is on trying to get some things done in a second term, he's making an effort.
Mm-hmm. And what does he want to get done?
I think immigration is first and foremost, and really it is the signal achievement that he's looking for this year, maybe in this two-year period, maybe in his whole second term. We'll have to see what the future may bring. But I think the most important thing to the president is that the immigration laws be overhauled In general, according to the principles that he has laid out, and in general, those are followed by the Gang of Eight bill that is coming before the Senate Judiciary Committee this very week.
Mm-hmm. Gun legislation off the table completely?
I don't think so. I think maybe a couple weeks ago I would have said 60-40. They'll bring it back for another vote this year. Maybe it's a little closer to 50-50 now. They need Pat Toomey, the fellow I was mentioning a moment ago, the Republican from Pennsylvania. They need him not only for cover because he's a strong conservative Republican, but also because he represents a group of people in the middle, both Democrat and Republican, who have to be on board if you're going to get to 60. He has said that he doesn't see a great opportunity for the bill to come back this year. On the other hand, the other person who was most responsible for the background checks compromise, Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, a Democrat, says he thinks it can come back this year. So they need to get Pat Toomey back on board. Pat Toomey has seen his polls go up to a rather high, I believe even a record high in Pennsylvania. So he has some political incentive to continue doing this. He certainly doesn't want to seem to have turned around and be opposed now to what he was offering on gun control. And so the background checks bill, just the background checks bill, slightly tweaked to maybe get two or three more votes from Republicans and a couple more votes from Democrats, could come back this year, call it 50-50.
Mm. Polls going up to a record high for Toomey because of his support for the background checks?
Yes, he got a lot of positive attention for that. And remember, this is an issue that does well, even in states that have a lot of gun owners. It does well, really, even among gun owners and even NRA members think universal background checks are not necessarily a bad idea. Now, certainly you can get to a hardcore that says, no, any kind of background checks implies you're making lists, you're making too much information available regarding people who are buying guns. Therefore, you're making a registration, backdoor registration of weapons, and that will lead to confiscation and so on. That was certainly the theme at the NRA convention this past week in Houston. They're very glad to have defeated that background check, even though the NRA itself used to support background checks. They have moved to this position now that it is somehow a precursor to registration and confiscation of guns. So it's a harder vote maybe than it would have seemed to have been right after Newtown, mm-hmm. Right back in December when it seemed that some kind of gun control was going to be inevitable. Now it doesn't look by any means inevitable. But it is still a popular notion to have universal background checks, especially in suburbs, especially in places like, say, the Philadelphia suburbs, which is where the swing vote of Pennsylvania lives.
Mm-hmm. Much as I hate to do it, it seems a long way off, but we got to do it, I guess. Bill Richardson said over the weekend, Democrats may see a face-off between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. I don't know, Ron, if Bill and Joe Biden are good friends, but he did say Joe Biden has always wanted to be president.
Well, Joe Biden has the job Bill Richardson wished he might have gotten back in 2008 when he wanted very much to be on the ticket with Barack Obama. I do not expect to see a primary contest between Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton. However, if Hillary Clinton, for any reason, were not to be running in 2016, then I believe Joe Biden would run, and he would not care that he's going to be in his 70s. He's already in his 70s. And yes, he would be the oldest president ever elected, older than Ronald Reagan was when he was first elected. So it's something Joe Biden, yes, would very much like to be able to do. And if Hillary Clinton is not in the field, I believe Joe Biden will be in the field. But if she is in the field, I don't think Joe Biden would see his chances as being sufficiently robust to make it make sense.
This story has haunted me ever since it happened, and I'm wondering if anybody in Washington is introducing any kind of legislation and what that may be to deal with this horrendous the death toll in Bangladesh is over 600 people now. I'm wondering how we're responding, if we are in any way to that horror, if the international community is responding.
The underlying problem with what has gone on in Bangladesh, of course, is the enormous, insatiable demand for inexpensive clothing.
Yeah.
We obviously didn't have anything to do with inspecting their buildings. We certainly were not responsible in this country for the behavior of the people who owned this factory. And having been warned, and I think even ordered to close the factory for after the discovery that it was an unsafe building, They went ahead. They kept the factory open. They ordered their workers to come to work. I mean, this all is horrendous. And obviously, the rest of the world doesn't bear responsibility for those individuals' behavior. But the rest of the world has been benefiting from an economic system by which clothing manufacture in particular goes wherever in the world it can be done most cheaply. And that then leads to people trying to compete with other countries by having lax and often corrupt enforcement of regulations, whether that has to do with child labor or the length of time people work. All the horrors that can be visited on a working population that is so desperately poor, as in this case in Bangladesh, people were, that they're willing to work under almost any conditions and at almost any hazard in order to have these jobs, which are better than what they had before those factories opened. It's the demand for super cheap clothing that drives all of that and drives that competition between these countries.
So you don't see any kind of legislation that would require that American companies who are doing business there make sure that the factories are safe, or that there would be some kind of inspection or something along those lines?
I believe there will be legislation proposed. I am not terribly sanguine that it will be enacted. Mm. And if it were enacted, how exactly it would be enforced. But it is an idea. It is a concept that that needs to be explored. What can we do to discourage this kind of business behavior in these places by having different business behavior in our country?
Ron Elving is our guest. It's All Things Political for this Monday morning, the 6th of May, and we welcome your phone calls. We'll move on to other topics, but we've already covered a lot in a short period of time. Here's how you reach our conversation. What are you thinking about as we talk about politics? We, of course, will talk about Israel. They're saying they're not really taking sides in the middle of serious civil war, but some would say otherwise. Would there be any kind of conversation, I want to ask Ron, between the Israel and the United States before these bombings took place, and what are the possible consequences here? Here's our phone number for you to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and everything is wide open for you at this very moment. Ron Elving is NPR News Senior Washington Editor, directing coverage of the nation's capital and national politics. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political, and our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What do you make of Ron's comments about the chief executive, President Obama, who he criticized during the press conference last week for saying too much over and over again? Okay, that didn't work out so well, but I tried to do what needed to be done, and the Republicans won't let me. Has he been too sarcastic? Is he not well-served by his tendency to sarcasm? And how do you, does this story weigh heavy on you as well, this Bangladesh garment tragedy, death toll now over 600 people? What do we do about that? We have to talk about Syria as well, and we'll do that at this very moment. Israel seeking to persuade, according to the news today, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad that its recent airstrikes around Damascus did not aim to weaken him in the face of a more than two-year-old rebellion. A question, why did Israel do this right now? And I'm always wondering, it would seem it's such a big thing to do that you would have to be in consultation with the United States before you did this, wouldn't you?
One would think. The official position of our government at this moment, as I understand it, is that we were not consulted. That might be true. It's also possible, one can imagine, that there would be reasons why we did not want to acknowledge that consultation, as in fact there are reasons why the Israelis do not want to officially take responsibility for these airstrikes, which it's pretty much impossible to imagine anyone else having done. And it's probably not even necessary for them to deny it. They're just not going to officially acknowledge it. I would imagine that there would need to be some kind of consultation, but at the same time, it might serve the purposes of both Israel and the United States for them to just go ahead and do it. In this case, I don't think the Israelis are so much taking sides in the Syrian civil war. They are on their own side. And what they see here is an opportunity to defend themselves from the kinds of weapons that they see being transshipped through Syria from Iran to the Hezbollah for use in, say, for example, Lebanon, where they might be launched into Israel. There are more and more sophisticated missile designs being made available to people who are willing to do that, and the Israelis saw an opportunity to intercept some of those missiles at the point where they were in storage, and that appears to be what they did.
Mm. And yet, how can you not see it? Because, of course, it would damage the Syrian president Assad's regime. Not that that shouldn't be damaged in some way, but it would appear, wouldn't it, that you are taking signs here, considering where they place the bombs?
In certainly when you consider it's his soldiers who are being killed, and when you consider that it is his policies that are being interdicted, and when you consider that it makes him look weak not to be able to defend his own capital city against Israeli jets, all of those things are negative from his point of view. But it is not that the Israelis are so eager to have the Syrian rebels take over in Damascus, because they're not at all certain that the dominant elements within that group will be any friendlier, probably less friendly, if anything, toward Israel. So they're not so much interested in deciding who the regime is going to be as they are interested in making sure that these moments are exploited from their standpoint to make Israel feel safer.
Hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And there was something with our phones, so the lines are all open for you right now. Don't be frustrated. You can get through if you call at this moment. Jamie in Waupun is our first caller. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. I had a question. I listen to Wisconsin Public Radio quite often. And after the gun reform debate and the vote, I was wondering, I don't remember ever hearing anybody question why Ron Johnson voted the way he did. And to even try to see if there was a representative from his office to say why he voted the way he did.
I don't know if you know the answer to that, but you can speak more generally, Ron, about why those who voted in opposition to universal background checks voted the way they did. The response is pretty similar, I would think.
Yes, and I don't know whether or not Ron Johnson was heard in the hours right after that particular vote, either on our air or either, that is to say, on a program that was produced here in Washington or from Wisconsin. But he has been quite clear on his position with respect to guns, and that that he does not see a need for new laws, but that he sees a need for the enforcement of existing laws and keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and so on, but that he was not a supporter of the universal background checks.
Thanks very much for the call, Jamie. I want to talk about Syria for one more moment before we go back to phone calls, because we've got Secretary of State John Kerry heading off for this trip to Russia, Russia at odds with the United States, warning about the rise of Islamists, particularly in Syria. So how does that get dealt with?
John Kerry is going to have to take an enormous load on his shoulders when he sits down with the Russians. We have a number of issues with the Russians right now, not the least of which is this this nascent kind of relationship in an anti-terror effort that is reflected in the Boston Massacre, or excuse me, the Boston Marathon bombing. This connection between the Tsarnaev brothers and Chechen elements that the Russians have been fighting for many years is what led the Russians to notify us several years ago about what they had heard about the radicalization, if you will, of the Tsarnaev family, both the brothers and their mother. And so we got a little bit of information from them. It bounced around in the intelligence community. It did not result in much other than an interview with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and as a result, they were never actually taken out of commission, taken out of circulation, and the Boston Marathon bombing eventually took place. That is something of an indictment of our intelligence operation, but you can also understand why our intelligence operation assessed the information we were getting from the Russians in the context of their extreme fear of Islamists in the Chechen part of their country. And they are, you know, always coming up with dozens of individuals every year that they want us to check out over on our side of the Atlantic. So this has to be seen in that larger context, but that has put a sharper edge on some of our discussions with the Russians, what we can do together and whether or not we're helping each other enough deal with what amounts to domestic terrorism by the time it actually takes place. That is the background. And then the foreground is, will the Russians continue to back the Assad regime in Syria? And will they continue to essentially make common cause with the Iranians in that part of the world? That is a relationship that has decades, generations behind it. It is part of the way the Russians project power into that part of the world. And they are extremely hesitant to back off the Assad regime, no matter what horrors it has perpetrated. So John Kerry has to go over there and try to make the case to them that they should look the other way while an international community force in some way or another weighs in that civil war and does not weigh in, of course, on the side of the Assad regime.
And Ron, why are they so supportive of the Assad regime?
This goes back for a long period of time. Syria was very much a client state of the old Soviet Union. They were the agents, if you will, for Moscow to a large degree in the Middle East through many decades. And this has been a part of the world where the Russians wanted always to project their power. This goes back centuries, and they have had long-standing relationships that have largely lined up against ours in the region. And they have provided not only weaponry and other forms of support, political support, but also markets for some of these countries and vice versa. And they have bought a lot of the Russians' technology. So they have a client kind of relationship with Syria and to a certain degree with Iran. And this is a large configuration of powers arrayed in the Middle East, and we have been engaged in this struggle with them for, as I say, generations.
We welcome more phone calls for Ron. Let's go to Bob in Milwaukee next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen. Question, an item that stuck with me over the last few weeks is when President Obama rescinded the order that prohibited congressmen and staffers from benefiting from inside information trading in the financial markets. When he signed the bill initially prohibiting it, I thought it was great. It was done with fanfare. When he rescinded it, it was done with no fanfare, and I'm very disappointed. I'd like some kind of reason why he did that, if Mr. Elving knows.
I didn't even know he had done that.
I am not familiar with that. When did he rescind that? And I'm not exactly sure what rescinding it means.
Canceled it out.
Well, but the Stock Act was a law that was passed by Congress and signed into law by the president.
Okay.
So I'm not familiar with him having the power to simply cancel it out.
I don't think it exists any longer. I saw the coverage of it on MSNBC and Rachel Maddow about 2 weeks ago.
All right. And they're saying that some element of the bill is not being enforced or something to that effect, or its application to certain people has been rescinded, perhaps. But I don't think he could. I don't think he could simply cancel out the Stock Act as enacted.
Okay, but the Stock Act is something that he signed.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so we don't know what the truth is here, so we need to drop this topic and find out more about what actually happened. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Ron Elving is our guest this hour. NPR News Senior Washington Editor Lucas is next in Madison. Hi, Lucas.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'd like to know what kinds of things exactly the president might do beyond having more barbecues and, you know, meeting with lawmakers to try to get his agenda through a Congress that has, you know, past Republicans that have so much interest in blocking that agenda. You know, I think it's worth remembering that LBJ had huge majorities in both houses. I don't think it's clear at all that if LBJ were here today, he'd have any more success. And the problem with that line of thinking is that it really takes the focus off of Congress, which is, after all, blocking policies that, you know, that have really widespread popular support, like gun control.
In the defense of LBJ, those huge Democratic majorities that he had in the House and the Senate were largely composed of Southern Democrats, not all of them, of course, not even most of them, but a very large portion of his majorities came from the South. In those days, the great majority of Southern senators were still Democrats, and certainly the overwhelming majority of the House Democrats were also from the South. Those people today are Republicans, and in those days they were called Democrats, but they were also quite conservative. In fact, the filibuster that was conducted against the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and that was the great challenge, the great conflict of LBJ's first year in office, that filibuster was conducted by Senate Democrats, by people from the South. Those states now primarily elect Republicans, and it's that same group of states that provide the core of opposition to the president. So LBJ was, in a sense, negotiating against that same, if you will, regional core of opposition and conservatism in his era, and had a different way of going about it. Of course, he was a Southern Democrat from Texas, and he had his own way of going about it. That path is largely closed to Barack Obama for a variety of reasons, and so it is not fair entirely to compare him to LBJ. And the reason people bring up LBJ is simply that his style was so much in contrast to Obama's, that he was so much more of an inside player and a guy who had been in Washington most of his life, mm-hmm. and Obama is not. So the things that Obama can actually do to get more cooperation from the Republicans, if I had an easy answer to that, I suspect there'd be a lot of people who wanted to hear it. I've said that I don't think that some of the behaviors that he has followed, such as the sarcasm and so forth, are particularly productive from his point of view. What might be more productive from his point of view, and one of the things you will see him do in the next week or two, is getting out on the hustings more, speaking out about his economic policies more, trying to get his approval rating up a little higher. And it's not bad for a second-term president at this point, considering all the things that he's dealing with. But if it were higher, if it were several points higher, if it were rising, that would have an effect on moderate Republicans. They would notice that. That would move them a little bit. He needs to get the Republicans worried that 2014 will not be a typical midterm election that helps them. They know it's not going to be another 2010 where they win all over the place, but they are hoping that 2014 will be a typical midterm election and bad for the president. If the president gets them worried that he's going to have his Democrats doing well in 2014, then you will see more behaviors change on Capitol Hill. He needs to do that.
What is he going to do? He said he doesn't want to see any of those 100 prisoners who are on hunger strike at Guantanamo die. What's he going to do about that?
There's a great deal of angst about what to do in Gitmo, and there has been right from the very beginning. I think there is probably no better symbolic issue for the Obama presidency to date than this one. He was so clear, he was so morally clear in 2008 about closing Guantanamo and getting past this episode where we held these people, these detainees, in this legal limbo in terms of the international community, in terms of our own law. And he wanted to bring them into the United States, try them in our courts, and have them incarcerated or have them freed depending on the result in our courts. That was rejected, essentially, not only by Congress, which got very afraid of that idea and afraid of the public disapproval that was attached to that idea. It was one of the first things the president got a lot of pushback from the right about. And even some Democrats said, hey, do we really want to be trying these guys in our courts? I mean, doesn't that make our big cities just a greater target for some kind of terrorism? And if we put them all in some sort of supermax prison out in the country, doesn't that make some otherwise safe and tranquil part of America suddenly at risk? So there was a huge resistance no one had really anticipated, certainly not in the White House, to the idea of just letting our regular justice system work with these individuals. So over those 4 years of the first term, they tried to get these folks all sent back to their countries of origin, more or less, except for the ones like, say, KSM, who was involved in 9/11, people like that. We didn't want to send back to their home countries. But a lot of these people were sent back to their home countries. Many others have been cleared from our standpoint to go back, but are not being accepted back into their home countries. Mm-hmm. So they are international orphans, if you will. And no, they don't want to be at Guantanamo, but there's no place else where people want them to be either.
Mm. Isn't it amazing we've had all these years to figure this out?
But the basic conundrum remains that if no one wants these people to be physically in their country, whether it's brought into our country for trial or incarceration or returned to their home country or some third country,
right.
If no one wants them, what do we do with them? They remain where they are. It's a little bit like Newton's law.
Yeah. Ron Elving is our guest for this All Things Political, and he is NPR News Senior Washington Editor, directing coverage of the nation's capital, national politics, and he does a great deal of on-air political analysis for many NPR programs. We're welcoming phone calls, and we have one line open right now. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. If you would prefer, you can send a message, WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday. Last week, Jason Collins became the first professional male athlete to come out as gay while still an active player. We will have two guests talking about the sports world and the LGBT community. We'll speak with the co-founder of Outsports.com, an online gay sports publication. And we'll also speak with a retired NFL player who played for the Green Bay Packers for some time and author of Alone in the Trenches, My Life as a Gay Man in the NFL. Back to phone calls. Christine in Madison, hello.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I have a question as to why everyone keeps saying that the defeat of the gun registration was Obama's defeat. I think that was a defeat for all of us. Certainly I was writing my congresspeople, and I think a lot of people were. I don't know what Obama could have done that was different. And that second question is, I find all this rhetoric coming out of the NRA very disturbing, and I don't hear enough pushback. I mean, all of this stuff about how we should be so frightened of our government is, to me, frightening.
Ron.
Interesting point. I have noticed a lot of headlines and journalistic sentences that refer to the defeat of the gun background checks bill as Obama's failure. Obama failed mm-hmm. to do this. Obama didn't do this. Of course, we should bear in mind this particular piece of legislation got 55 votes on the key vote. That is not 60. But it is a majority of the Senate, and it is only the Senate rules that require 60 votes to cut off debate that made it necessary to make each of these key votes a 60-vote vote. And that is a defeat, I suppose, you would have to say, for the backers of background checks, because we will not have the background checks. So they are, in that sense, defeated. But is it a failure to attempt to get this and to be stymied by a hardcore group that refuses to compromise on this issue? That, I think, is a debate of language, but it's also a political debate. Is it the president's responsibility to make things happen even if there is that much resistance to them in the Congress, or is that our federal system working the way it's supposed to work? Is it a failure or is it just a defeat?
You mentioned Toomey's numbers going up significantly. What about the problems that some of the senators who voted against this have been facing? Are we making too much of that, or are they losing support?
This is, I think, a straw in the wind. Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, who is a first-term senator, and a woman to whom the Republicans in the Senate are looking increasingly for big things in the future, to be a leader, to possibly be on the national ticket. She was courted. She is thought of as a moderate in the sort of New England sense, and she was the only no vote on background checks in the northeastern region of the United States. So she was out of step with most of the senators from her region, overwhelmingly out of step with them, and more in step with those from the South and the Mountain West. So she was a target, and her polling numbers have dropped rather notably, and she had several very uncomfortable moments in town halls up there in New Hampshire, particularly one with Erica Lafferty, who is the daughter of the woman who is the principal
yes.
at Newtown, Sandy Hook Elementary. That was a very emotional moment, and of course the videotape of that has been seen widely since. So that's what happened to Kelly Ayotte, and some people believe that she might have been been softened up enough by some of that that she could be on board for a somewhat tweaked version of the Manchin-Toomey gun background checks legislation down the road. Another fellow is Jeff Flake from Arizona, who is personal friends and really sincere friends, long-standing friends, with Gabby Giffords from his home state of Arizona. And Jeff Flake was thought to be, although a Westerner and a longtime supporter of the NRA and the Second Amendment, was thought to be open to the idea of this compromise legislation on background checks. And that's all it is, by the way. I mean, this is not some gun control bill. I mean, this is not the sort of thing that real gun control advocates would ultimately want to see. This is simply universalizing the background checks that are now supposed to already be in place to keep criminals and people with other serious reasons not to have a gun away from weapons sales. So at this point, we thought Jeff Flake might be one more of those Republican votes to get to 60, but in the end, he bailed. He didn't do it. He's seen some pushback back in Arizona, which is increasingly a swing state. So Jeff Flake might be another vote that could be gettable if we got to the brink of 60, but we need to get several more before we get Jeff Flake.
Hmm. Thanks, Christine, for the call. Keith in Kewaunee. Hi.
Hi. I was just going to go back to Ron's opening statements about not being legally responsible for what happened in the building collapse in Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're not legally responsible. I think morally and ethically, the big corporations, the Walmarts, the Nikes of the world that exploit slave labor around the world to get their cheap goods so Americans can buy cheap things, I think is totally wrong. And back in 2006, there were proposed laws, bills, in the House and the Senate that would have made it illegal for companies to import goods that were produced by slave labor and hold those companies responsible. And I'm hoping that maybe this will generate enough interest to revive those bills and maybe we can get something done.
Thanks for the call, Keith.
That's a good story. That's a good story going forward that I think a lot of people are going to pursue. I think a lot of people would very much like to revive those bills and would very much like to put this issue before the public, just to, you know, ask yourself, in what sense are we all complicit in this addiction to the lowest possible price for these basic goods? And is there any way that consumers could express their own sense of involvement in these acts overseas that seem so remote and seem so not our problem? Is there any way for consumers to make that real in the marketplace? And is there any way for voters to make that real in the political sphere?
Yeah. I mean, he's absolutely right. There is a moral issue on this. That's what weighs heavy on the soul on this issue. There is an issue that we want, and part of, we were talking to Charlie Kernaghan last week about this, who's been exposing these conditions for years and years and years, and he said that the possibilities of a big movement are not very great because economic times are tough here, and people, of course, want to find the cheapest thing, and so you don't think about who made that necessarily. You're thinking about how hard it is for you to make a living.
Exactly. It's the same, not the same, but it is a similar moral conundrum to that which we undergo all the time with respect to energy. We know that the generation of energy is deadly for a lot of the people involved in it, coal miners and so on. But we go on using those forms of energy. And we also know that in the long run, the forms of energy that we use are hugely damaging to the planet, and yet we go on using them.
Yeah. Keith, thanks for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Whistleblowers are always favored by the left wing when there's a Republican president, but somehow the whistleblowers are usually ignored by people when they expose Obama, either his anti-white racism Justice Department, J. Christian Adams was the main whistleblower there, or now the Benghazi whistleblowers, who are going to testify, I think, this week before Congress on how the Obama administration and Rice lied to the American people, bringing up this fake video, and when it was really a terrorist attack that killed the American ambassador to Libya. You know, Obama simply, his support of Arab Spring the support of the Muslim Brotherhood and their persecution of the Christian churches. 10% of the people of Egypt are Christian. They're constantly being persecuted now under this Muslim Brotherhood crowd with links to one of Hillary's main advisors. This is a pro-Islamic administration. They refuse to attack, say, a jihad when the Muslim fanatics are the ones killing our people. It is a horrible administration. I'm so sorry that the American people reelected Obama.
Ron.
Yes, the whistleblowers in question here are people connected to the State Department in various ways who feel they have a case to make that the State Department under Hillary Clinton and under this White House did not give a straight story but gave a political cover-up story about Benghazi back in September. This, of course, was the attack on our Benghazi consulate where our ambassador was that day and was killed along with three other Americans. The accounts after that were clouded, were confused, were, in the minds of many, deceptive. To protect the president weeks before his reelection campaign, his reelection day. This is a live issue, and it's particularly a live issue for many people who are not fans of the administration. And these whistleblowers who allege that they have been in some sense or another suppressed are going to be testifying this week before Congress, and we'll see what they have to say. It'll be a very much an open session.
Let's go next to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yo, Hillary Clinton, former Secretary Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, among others, have shown themselves to have been very formidable secretaries of state. Does the guest think that John Kerry has the intellectual wattage or the diplomatic chops to go against the Vladimir Putin? I have my doubts about that.
All right, let's get a response. Ron.
Hillary Clinton was a pretty successful Secretary of State, notwithstanding what we were just talking about a moment ago, which is going to obviously be part of her record and part of the debate about her record, that is to say Benghazi. More generally, across the political spectrum, there was more respect for her performance than maybe anyone would have predicted when she first became Secretary of State. She was, by most measures, quite successful. It's interesting to think that John Kerry, who had more or less, in many respects, spent his entire life preparing for a foreign service kind of a career, and then, of course, as a senator preparing to be perhaps president and lead our foreign policy, being a presidential candidate. He has, as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and so on, an extraordinary background for being Secretary of State. And yet, at this moment, people are asking, will he be heavyweight enough to do the job as Hillary Clinton was, somebody who didn't have anywhere near the same credentials going into the job? So that's how perceptions change from year to year. John Kerry has great credentials on paper. But the caller is right to ask the question, does that really mean that he will be able to negotiate with Vladimir Putin or with the North Koreans or with the Syrians or to make whatever needs to happen from the standpoint of the United States interests happen? That remains to be proven. He is just getting his feet wet.
Mm-hmm. What an exhausting job that must be.
Really. It's exhausting just for the travel.
I know. Thanks, Bill, for the call. Risa in River Falls. Hi, Risa.
Hi, it's actually Lisa.
Lisa? Hi, Lisa.
Yes, hi. I'm calling regarding the Bangladesh situation. I have a little different opinion than I've been hearing, and I wanted to express it. I feel that it's the responsibility of the factory owners to charge more money to keep their factories and their employees safe, and that it's the responsibility factories operate to create and enforce safety regulations. I just don't think a consumer somewhere, say, in Wisconsin, has much impact or any responsibility for the cost of clothing. And since the market, drives price, I think that we should be holding governments and factories responsible to increase prices to make sure people are safe.
Run.
I think taking a long look, you know, from 35,000 feet at how this whole system works, how the market system works with respect to clothing globally, is a good thing for us all to do. But I certainly wouldn't want to imply that the nature of our shared responsibility was on a par with or comparable to the responsibility of either corrupt government officials who may have taken bribes to look the other way in some of these instances, or, for that matter, the factory owners who, in the face of solid information that their building was unsafe, still wanted people to come to work and made them come to work. That individual, in this particular case, I believe, is incarcerated and is going to possibly face indictment for and possibly with the death penalty out there. That is a responsibility for certain. And all those others along the chain, the supply chain, mm-hmm. need to think, what is my responsibility that led up to these events?
Yeah. Ron, always a great pleasure to have you on with us. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen. Really fun to be with you. Yeah. Glad to be with you.
Good. Well, we'll ask you again then if you had fun. That's good. Ron Elving, our guest, NPR News senior Washington editor. He directs coverage of the nation's capital and national politics, provides on-air political analysis for many NPR programs, and also worked for the Milwaukee Journal for some time, so he has Wisconsin connections. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we will return to talk about gay athletes and the professional sports world.